This is an RNZ podcast.
Kia ora, I'm Corin Dan, and welcome to this morning's episode of Morning Report. Essentials, and high on the list this morning was the essential element of coal, with Genesis Energy confirming that they are going to have to bring more coal in from overseas to keep the lights on, essentially, or guarantee that they stay on. Shane Jones was on the program. As you can imagine, Ingrid, some pretty excitable language and a very interesting interview.
Yeah, and he's come up with another phrase, another winner in his eyes. What was it? Coal before Dole. So he'll be putting that on a bumper sticker or a T-shirt at some stage. Also, that is essential listening. I'm not sure I can wholeheartedly recommend the Eurovision interview, but, you know, it's...
You're not a fan of baby lasagna?
I don't know. No.
What about Bambi Thug?
No, none of the above. It was an interest. I mean, some people, millions of people love it, so who am I to argue, really? And the rest of the podcast is essential listening and wholeheartedly recommended. Do enjoy the episode. Over at Parliament, the last 7 days have been peppered with the calls of bad behaviour in the House. Green MP Julianne Gender has been referred to the Privileges Committee after National accused her of intimidating and attacking one of their ministers. And as we've been hearing this morning, Te Pāti Māori are facing a backlash for the use of inflammatory language. Elsewhere in the precinct, the government spent part of yesterday mopping out the fallout from a confusing and contradictory press conference on new corrections funding. Here to discuss all of that is Opposition Leader Chris Hipkins. Kia ora, good morning.
Good morning.
Let's start with the behaviour of our politicians at the moment. Do you have any concerns about the behaviour or the tone of language being used in Parliament at the moment?
I mean, I think those kind of inflammatory statements aren't helpful. I don't think it was helpful when Winston Peters compared New Zealand to Nazi Germany. I don't think the statements from the Māori Party are particularly helpful either. I think everybody should take a deep breath here. You know, New Zealanders rely on us debating passionately. That's the essence of democracy. I think it's vital for democracy. But I think saying stuff that's deliberately inflammatory and just frankly isn't true doesn't help.
Have you given a direction to your members not to use that sort of language?
Of course, then. I mean, I don't believe I need to, and we haven't seen any evidence of them doing so. I do expect them to say things that are, on occasion, they'll be controversial and they'll be passionate because I want people to speak from the heart. That's the nature of politics. But, you know, let's try and stay grounded in reality.
There's been a report, obviously, about the election results and some issues there around special votes and a call maybe to end voting day enrolments. What's your view on that?
Well, it's the job of the Electoral Commission to make sure we run an election in which everybody can participate. I think that taking away the right of thousands of people to vote because the Electoral Commission didn't do its job properly isn't the answer. The Electoral Commission should make sure that the system runs smoothly. Thousands of people enrolled and voted on the day. If they're saying that they'll stop that happening, they're basically saying that thousands of people won't have their vote counted. The whole purpose of an independent electoral commission is to make sure that everybody's vote is counted and the election is run with integrity.
Would you be supportive of them of more funding? They say they need a few extra, beg your pardon, 100 staff to ensure it does run smoothly. Would you support that extra funding?
We did give them extra funding, but we didn't give them the same level of funding they had in 2020. And the reason for that was in 2020 they were running an election in the midst of the global pandemic and they had to plan for a whole variety of scenarios, including an outbreak of COVID-19 right in the middle of the voting period. Clearly the measures we put in place there we didn't need to do for every election, but they did get more funding.
Corrections, that was a big announcement from the government this week, as we've mentioned, a confusing press conference, but they have committed $1.9 billion of funding to corrections and they're delivering the beds some of which were promised during your government's time and not delivered.
Well, the 600 beds that we committed to and that we funded were delayed because of COVID-19. So they were promised just before the pandemic, and the pandemic delayed many, many things, including in the private sector. So this was not limited just to government. And those prison beds were, as when we left government, on track to be delivered by the end of this year. If the timeframe for that's been extended further, then obviously that's a decision of the current government's, not ours. In terms of the funding for the 810 beds, that they announced. Well, that's all a bit of a mystery, because they still won't say where the money is coming from, what it's going towards, how much is of its capital funding, how much of its operating funding, how much of it is one-off funding, how much else is ongoing, or in fact what we're actually going to get for that. So I think, you know, the government's announcement, they've made a pre-budget announcement and they're now saying, well, they won't answer any questions about it because it's budget sensitive.
Well, just in terms of the breakdown of how that money is being divvied up, are you supportive of the extra money going into rehabilitation services for prisoners?
Of course, I support rehabilitation, but there's a challenge here. What they're doing is they're providing more rehabilitation to prisoners who are on remand. So these are, in many cases, prisoners who have not yet been convicted. So they're being offered rehabilitation for a crime that we have not yet proven that they actually did. And that creates some interesting challenges, and it's the reason why prisons on remand typically haven't been given rehabilitation programs. Given the length of time prisons are spending on remand, I think it is probably justified.
Carmel Cipollone, has she been on a Celebrity Treasure Island?
Carmel took a couple of weeks off earlier in the year. I approved her taking a couple of weeks off. I think after, you know, 6 years, very busy years as a minister, you know, she was invited to take a bit of time off. What she did during that time, those are questions for her.
Well, if it turns out she was on Celebrity Treasure Island, is that appropriate for her to be taking time off to do that in a sort of busy parliamentary period?
I think everyone's entitled to take time off. Obviously, I can't comment on this particular instance. And I think people will accept that. I understand that I can't always comment on individual issues like this. But what I have also set out, you know, clearly in the past is where MPs are taking time off to do something that is not necessarily personal, but not related directly to their work, then there are ways that we can manage that. MPs have donated their salary to charity, for example, in the past where they've done those sorts of things. And my expectation is that that would continue in any instances in the future where that was to happen.
Would you appear on Celebrity Treasure Island if the invitation was forthcoming?
Not something that I would consider at this point in time, no.
A Te Pāti Māori MP is facing backlash from across the political spectrum for using inflammatory language in the House. Maria Meno Kapakingi last week accused the government of having a, quote, mission to exterminate Māori through its changes to the Oranga Tamariki Act. MPs from every other political party have responded, saying such language is not appropriate.
Completely out of line. Rhetoric needs to calm down big time across the whole of the political spectrum.
This government, all three parties have Māori members in cabinet. It would be rather unusual if we're off to exterminate ourselves.
Oh, no. Of course not.
I myself would not use those words.
That kind of language isn't helpful, and it's certainly not language that I agree with.
Māori Meno Kapakingi joins us now. Kia ora, good morning.
Good morning, Ingrid.
Why would you say that the government is on a mission to exterminate Māori?
The context, I think, is important, Ingrid, and it's to, and specifically when we're talking about 7AA and our mokopuna. So I just want to start out by making that comment. The fact is, words matter, obviously. And when I've used words like deculturation, for instance, or alienation or colonization, they fall on deaf ears. You know, like maybe they just don't understand the word. That's also possible. But when I'm choosing words and describing our situation, I was very deliberate and very clear about. And if that's the word that has people sit up and take notice of what it feels like for our mokopuna and our whānau, what it sounds like, the tone of the discussion on a daily basis in the House, if that's the word that has people have feelings, and it seems people are having feelings, then so be it.
So this is about attention seeking.
This is about describing our situation in our own way without being dictated by how people are going to have feelings about it. This is about our right to describe, in Pākehā, by the way, how to to explain what it feels like when other words don't land and it falls on deaf ears, and it describes what disconnection, what alienation, what colonization does. It lands there. And so when we're suffering the process of listening to bills which have words like repeal, ban, stop, all of these bills, which, by the way, many impact on Māori life, Māori existence, then that's what it takes.
Mm. But you've just used a lot of words there to describe how you are feeling without using the word exterminate. Exterminate has a specific meaning. It's wiping out someone, and when that hasn't actually happened, no one's been exterminated.
Well, actually, interesting. Last night I sat in the house listening to a discussion about a iwi that had just going through the process of settlement, right? And, of course, words, it was all very apologetic. And the apology was about how many people that died and were exterminated and were disenfranchised and were gotten rid of, by the way.
Yeah, so I'm talking, though, as it relates to the current debate you were having, which is around the Oranga Tamariki changes, which is different.
Well, but is it, though? Because might we then have to suffer another set of apologies in the next 20 years? I thought, sorry about that, 7AA. Look, we were wrong. We shouldn't have done that. We should have actually held the CEO to account for what it means for Māori kaupapa, Māori children with whakapapa, that is their identity. Those are the things that this 7AA repeal is, to decide a piece of legislation with a phrase like, we should be colorblind. So you can hear the reference in that, Ingrid, which is to be colorblind, which means to be what? So if you took away the beautiful brown hue in my skin, what does that leave? White. And if that leaves white, then let's all be white.
Do you really think, though, that the Children's Minister, Karen Chua, she is a Māori woman who went through state care. Do you really think she wants to do anything to hurt Māori tamariki in pushing for these changes?
The whole movement, the whole act towards reducing 7AA is absolutely about removing the rights and the protection under Te Tiriti o Waitangi, to remove those, and all under the statement of her being colorblind. Now, honestly, that's a so I think what she's doing and how she's doing it, sadly, that's her and her party's decision to live with. But as far as the party Māori, as far as we're concerned, we will not sit quietly while they smooth the pillow, and we have to tolerate that this another act of oppression, another act of deculturation, which all ends up equals extermination.
Genesis Energy is to resume importing coal to burn at Huntly Power Station. Genesis hasn't imported coal since mid-2022, but it says with gas supply falling faster than projected, it's currently the only affordable option to keep the country's lights on. Chief Executive Malcolm John says it's having to use its 500,000-tonne stockpile at the Huntly Station to counter a 30% fall in gas production and lower hydro lake inflows to ensure security of supply.
New Zealand ultimately has a high renewables grid anyway, but as we add more wind and solar into it, that energy is intermittent, and it causes a yo-yoing effect on thermal. Primarily, we've burnt gas up until this point, but as gas goes shorter in the market with the declining production levels in New Zealand, as we transition to a more renewables future, we're going to have to use more solid energy to bridge that gap. We believe going forward that the solid fuel level between biomass and coal that we need to maintain at Huntly is around 350,000 tonnes. By the end of this winter, we will have gone below that level, and so we will need to top the stockpile up ahead of next winter.
Now, the Resource Minister is Shane Jones, who joins us now. Kia ora. Good morning, Minister.
Morning. Greetings, folks.
I wonder if we just get a quick comment from you on the earlier interview before we get into the coal issue. Maramino Kapakingi's comments around extermination of Māori. Look, you've been a great user of rhetoric in the past. She claims it was a rhetorical device to express how Māori are feeling. Is that reasonable?
Words do matter, mate. Sadly, I think she's been influenced by Debbie Ngāre Wapaka. But look, Maria Mino is from the Taitokero. She's from a similar iwi background than me, but those are not words that I would use.
Are you comfortable with the changes to the removal of 7AA that will mean less Māori involvement in the removal potentially of children, the placement of children?
Yeah, I think the thing has become an ideological battleground, and I just fear that the well-being of young New Zealanders, irrespective of their ethnicity, whether they're Chinese, Pākehā, Māori, whatever they are, they run the risk of turning into puppets in an ideological battle about the treaty. And I've never understood as to why the principles of the treaty have loomed so large in determining where a warm, safe, reliable home could be found for little Rangi or Hene Moa.
Well, that's because there's been numerous reports from on Oranga Tamariki suggesting they haven't been serving Māori children very well.
Well, there's some hard truths that have got to be spoken here. I mean, a lot of the responsibility for the treatment meted out to our tamariki and our mokopuna has to be sheeted back to us as Māori ourselves. And this business that somehow we can continually blame the state for this ongoing wickedness, which we're reading about on a regular basis in the newspaper, I don't subscribe to this notion that it's purely a state problem. The problem also lies within the deep dysfunctionalism that's too frequently found amongst a number of our own whānau. And sure, a number of those whānau can be rehabilitated and the tamariki and the kids should be taken and put in more secure homes. But surely the most important thing is a safe, loving, value-based family, irrespective of their whakapapa.
Okay, look, we may have to carry on that conversation at another time, I think. There's plenty more to talk about there, but we did get you on to talk about coal because there is an interesting development here. And that is that Genesis is going to start importing coal again. Can you or will you look at changing resource management laws so that Genesis could actually use local coal?
And you ask a great question because you know my whakatauki, my proverb is coal before dole. I'm told that it's easier to import Indonesian coal because of the investment required in redeveloping our own coal fields and the fact that as we continue the march towards clean green energy, it's only on an intermittent basis that coal will be needed, and therefore it's a more rational decision to bring the coal in. But just step back for a moment.
We haven't got that much time. I need an answer on that question because the issue here is that we have the coal that could be burnt, but it is poorer quality, higher emitting, and there would need to be changes to the Resource Management Act in order to dig it up and use it. And I'm asking you, are you going to do that?
Yeah, but I've already been on your program and announced that we've changed the rules pertaining to coal. I announced that 3 weeks ago. That's not new news. The government has already said we are changing the RMA to overcome this green unicorn thinking that we can't use or create exports.
So do you expect...
You should already know that.
Well, I do, but I want to know if are you expecting Genesis then to be able to get access to that poorer quality coal and start using it?
Well, we already have Bathurst and other companies in New Zealand that are in the coal business, and Genesis is capable of buying from who they like. The fact that we've had disruptiveness in the gas industry means we're now relying more on coal. How perverse. How perverse from 2018-19 when Jacinda Ardern promised this new nirvana, now we're going to burn more coal.
Why do we want to focus on coal? What don't we need to be going to biomass, which is the end game for Genesis? This is wood pellets. You've got batteries. You've got the ability to increase wind and solar so that there's more water in the lakes. If we burn more coal, we are simply going to be putting more emissions into the atmosphere. We'll be paying for it with carbon credits, and we'll be paying for it with the environment.
Without a doubt, the investment should continue in solar and wind, and hopefully the gods of weather will give us more rain. But today in Alberta, in Canada, the lights don't stay on all the time because of intermittency. We need a contingency. We need a backup. Historically, it has been gas. There's gas under our feet. We can create more and more, greater supplies of gas, but it's going to need more investment. And until such time, our energy system, in order to keep the lights on and the hospitals functioning and the schools working, we're going to need hard energy, and that's going to come in the form of coal. It's not ideal, but I'll take that in a hot shower before this kind of unicorn thinking that we can rely incessantly on the vagaries of green energy at a time when not all of the technology is up to the task.
Are you saying that the batteries aren't up to the task, that we can't electrify industry, that we can't move to biomass? I mean, these are viable options?
They're viable, providing that investors can make money out of them and bring the energy to the market, Corin, at a level that the market can stand. Other than that, the market is going to continue. And I think Genesis should be on the honours list. Without them, there's no guarantee the lights will
stay. Let me put this to you then. I mean, you're saying we need to extract more gas, and you have to attract multinational companies to come down here and do it. Is that viable? Are they coming? Do they want to come, even if you overturn the ban on offshore drilling? Because there's a huge risk here that a government may change and change the rules on them. You effectively have to step in and provide them with an insurance policy.
Well, we have a household name in the form of Todd. They're already in the gas industry. We have an Austrian company here called OMV who have not left us. And we have Methanex, a fantastic employer and a major producer of methanol on the back of natural gas. It's under the ground. We have it. All the government needs to do is work with those parties to ensure we give a set of regulations that incentivise them to go and extract.
What's that incentive going to be? What will they get? Will they get concessions on having to clean up after they've left? Will they get some form of a bond or insurance so that they know that they won't have the rug pulled out from them if another government comes in with a different view and says, no, we don't want this anymore?
Yeah, you ask a good question, mate. The first thing that's going to happen is going to change the law, and we're going to overcome that foolish ban of 4 or 5 years ago. So that's on the books. Secondly, we are going to revisit the burdensome nature of the decommissioning obligations and ensure that they're not a threat or they're not a bar to fresh investment. But we have the money in and around the industry. What the industry is looking for is confidence from not only the regulators, but the confidence that the market is there.
Okay.
We have a market in gas. Now, I'll say one thing. The generators must not use this uncertainty as an opportunity, Meridian and others, to gouge consumers.
Okay, but you're also saying, that in terms of cleaning up after you've finished drilling, you're going to make it less burdensome. You're going to say you don't have to clean up as much.
No, very soon I'm going to have a paper going to cabinet, and it's going to cover off not only dismissal of Jacinda Ardern's ban, but we're also going to revisit the mix of obligations that are on the investors, on the actual extractors of gas, so that it's not...
You're aware that it was Tamarind cost this country, what, $400 million? With their drill, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, Tamarind, sadly, the name of a nice tree blighted permanently in New Zealand was between...
So why would you make it easier for an oil company to leave after they've done the drilling?
No, I'm not saying that it'll necessarily be easier, but just because you pass a law and you feel very fuzzy about it in Wellington, you need to be confident that it doesn't have a disincentivising or chilling effect on investment. That's how economics in the real world works.
Final question. How do you think our neighbours in the Pacific will feel about New Zealand restarting drilling for oil and gas offshore and the impact on the environment and the increased emissions from digging up more fossil fuels, which the UN says we don't need to do? How do you think those Pacific neighbours will feel about that?
Oh, I think that the Pacific realise that New Zealand, we are serious contributors to their welfare in the Pacific, and they know in order for us to generate an economic dividend in New Zealand, we need a reliable, and we need an affordable level of energy.
Even the countries where the water, even where the water's lapping at their, you know, at their towns.
Yeah, you've got to stop this left-wing catastrophisation.
I'm not catastrophising. This is there's been views expressed from Pacific Islands of concern about New Zealand overturning this ban.
Yeah, but us keeping the lights on and the hospitals functioning, we can't hold. You can't hold that type of thinking responsible for the tide lapping around Tuvalu. Come on, give us a break.
There we go, Eurovision there. Let's see if we can bring it up because it's well worth a listen. Did I overstate that? Well worth the listen? Well, you know.
Possibly.
Eurovision semi-finals have kicked off, and those are some of the top contenders this year. Malmö in Sweden is playing host this year after taking out the top prize in 2023 with the song contest promising a lot of drama on stage, possibly protests too in the streets. Of course, the contest has drawn criticism this year for its inclusion of Israel during its war in Gaza. Some fans accusing Eurovision of hypocrisy as Russia was excluded from the competition following their invasion of Ukraine. Now, earlier I spoke to Eurovision journalist Callum Rowe about some of the standout acts this year.
The first one I have to mention is a singer called Baby Lasagna. He's representing Croatia this year with a song called Rin Tin Taggy Din. It's a very public-friendly song. It's a little bit zany. The whole performance is kind of a sing-along chorus for the entire arena. I've seen him doing some rehearsals today and yesterday, and I've never seen or heard such a popular reaction to a Eurovision song before. I'll also mention Ireland as well. Ireland don't particularly do very well at Eurovision. However, they've sent a singer called Bambi Thug this year, and they do sort of a witchcraft pop artistic performance, and that is rising in the bookies odds this week. So don't count out Ireland from a very strong result.
Nemo, what's that song all about?
Yeah, Nemo, this is the act who is representing Switzerland this year. They're an out and non-binary artist, and their song is called The Code, which is all about their kind of a journey of self-discovery and finding their sexuality and their identity. I describe it as a futuristic Bond song. It's a mix of pop and opera and rap. It's unlike anything I've ever heard before.
What is the secret then? I mean, what is the essence? What is that genius about a winning Eurovision song?
There are three magic ingredients that I tell everybody that they need for a Eurovision winning song. And first of all, you've got to have a song. You've got to have the song that can capture Eurovision audiences and juries across the continent. You've also got to have a singer who is capable of the live performance. They've got to have the strong vocal to be able to nail a three-minute perfect live performance, and you've got to have the staging. If you don't have staging, you're bust. It's staging or bust. So it's those three magic ingredients, the singer, the song, and the staging. If you don't have those, you don't stand a chance.
The format, the voting, how does that all work? Just run us through it very quickly if you can.
Yeah, so in the two live semi-finals, which are on the Tuesday and Thursday here in Sweden, it's 100% televote, so it's just the public at home who decide the 10 qualifiers from each show that make it to the final. In the grand final itself, it's a 50-50 split between the televoters at home, so you and me who are watching, who are choosing their favourites, and each country is represented by a six-person professional jury made of industry experts. Split those votes in half, and whoever comes out on top with most points wins it.
We've got a war in Ukraine, a difficult economic climate, plenty of things for people to be a bit unhappy and miserable about at the moment, frankly. What is the tone, then, of Eurovision?
Yeah, I mean, I have to admit straight away, you know, we're talking now with a war going on with one of the participants, Israel, in this year's contest, and their participation in the contest this year is very controversial. Some people are for it and some people are against it. But I have to say, I've been in Malmö for a few days now, and it doesn't feel unsafe. It doesn't feel that it's uncomfortable that Israel is participating in it. However, on Thursday, Israel participate in their semi-final. There are pro and anti-Israel protests planned around the arena on Thursday, and indeed on Saturday, should Israel make it to the grand final. once the shows, the Eurovision shows begin, we get lost in the music, we get lost in the art. There is no other event like Eurovision that brings together a continent and indeed the whole world down to New Zealand as well.
And that's today's Morning Report podcast.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. Do tune in tomorrow wherever you get your podcasts from. The South Island Takahe. RNZ National.